And welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 1013, www.freakradio.org, on Thursday, February 23rd. And I want to ask you to please have a pencil, pen, or your screen ready so that you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, whatever it takes to get the information that you're going to need to take action. And unfortunately, we have to start off with another sad story from Honduras. We read that Jose Santos Sevilla, an earth defender, has been murdered in this story from Conflictos Mineros, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Jose Santos Sevilla, leader of the Tolopan tribe, is another example of what it means to be an earth defender in Honduras. In the municipality of Orica, this environmentalist was murdered during the morning hours when five people broke into his home and shot him repeatedly. The professor and indigenous leader Jose Santos Sevilla was murdered by gunshots by five men who broke into his home in Montaña de la Flor, Mountain of Flowers, 43 miles north of Tegucigalpa, affirmed Bertha Oliva, coordinator of the Committee of Family Members of Those Detained and Disappeared in Honduras. Oliva affirmed that with Sevilla, it was the same as with Berta Caceres, and this coincides with what was said in the report by Global Witness that earth defenders and environmentalists are in danger of being murdered. The indigenous leader was professor in the Ceiba community. Although it is not known why he was murdered, Global Witness had warned of the risks to this indigenous community of Tolopan, made up of 18,000 people from 28 different tribes who are defending their ancestral lands. The Orica mayor, Alejandro Rodriguez, said that he would make sure the facts get investigated. The publication, Honduras, the Most Dangerous Place to Defend on the Planet, denounced the more than 120 murders of defenders since 2010, and which, according to investigations and community complaints, consists of crimes in which those responsible are the, quote, rich elite and powerful people of the country, among them members of the political class. In Honduras, environmentalists have been getting murdered for opposing hydroelectric dams and mining projects, since these are imposed on indigenous land, affecting the ecosystems and community rights. Earth defender Jose Santos Sevilla, murdered in Honduras. And the Steve Irwin is back from Antarctica in this story written by Paul Watson of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. The Steve Irwin has arrived in Dunedin, North New Zealand. One of the Harpoon's boats followed it all the way back to New Zealand waters. The Ocean Warrior is still chasing the Nishin Maru and is being hunted by a second of the three Harpoon vessels. The Japanese whalers have doubled their kill area and reduced their kill quota. This makes them harder to catch with less time to catch them in. Operation Nemesis is almost over, but it has been a great success despite the ships being unable to engage the Nishin Maru at close quarters. Despite some claims that the whaling fleet has returned to Japan, Captain Adam Meyerson of the Ocean Warrior said today he had one of the Harpoon ships in sight. The reason for this is really bad weather, expensive tracking technology, and much greater killing area. However, there are some positive points. The fleet has three Harpoon boats, and two of them have spent most of their time trying to chase the Sea Shepherd ships over the last 2.5 months. The factory ship has been on the run continuously, making it difficult to get their quota of 333 whales. Because of Sea Shepherd's past interventions, the kill quota, although still illegal, has been reduced from 1,035 whales to 333. Because of Sea Shepherd's past intervention, not a single whale was slaughtered during the 2014-2015 season. Having only one Harpoon vessel and continuously on the run, the whaling fleet has spent an enormous amount of energy and money on extra fuel and supplies. The Sea Shepherd helicopter did document illegal whaling in Australian territorial waters. The factory ship was lost again due to severe weather. Will they get their quota? We don't know, but if they do, Sea Shepherd will have forced them to pay dearly for it. Consider that prior to Sea Shepherd's interventions, the whaling fleet took 2.5 months to kill 1,035 whales. With the fleet now down in the Southern Ocean, why have they spent 2.5 months to try and kill 333 whales? Sea Shepherd is a small conservation movement, has made amazing progress almost every year since 2005 in combating the highly illegal activity by one of the world's most powerful nations. The volunteer men and women on the Steve Irwin and the Ocean Warrior have done an absolutely incredible job exposing and opposing illegal Japanese whaling operations in the Southern Ocean this season. They dedicated their time, took time away from their families, especially over Christmas. They weathered quite a few storms and hazardous ice conditions and brought the Japanese crimes once again before the eyes of the world. Operation Nemesis has kept the entire Japanese whaling fleet on the move continuously, costing them time, costing them money, and keeping two-thirds of the fleet of harpoon boats busy and not whaling the entire season. The crew have earned some shore time in Dunedin, New Zealand. Meanwhile, the Ocean Warrior carries on the pursuit a few thousand miles to the south. And you can find out more information about the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society at www.seashepherd.org.au. And Sea Shepherd launches Operation Solus Stella with the Liberian government in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. For the past 3 weeks, Sea Shepherd has been secretly patrolling the waters of the Republic of Liberia in Western Africa in a covert operation to tackle illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing. Working in partnership with the Liberian Ministry of National Defense under the coordination of Honorable Minister Brownie Sumakai, the motor yacht Bob Barker is patrolling Liberia's coastline with 20 crew under the command of Captain Fraser Hall, 10 Liberian Coast Guard sailors with the authority to board, inspect, and arrest ships violating Liberian law, and 2 Israeli maritime advisors and conservationists providing training assistance. On February 3rd, fishing vessel Hispasan 7, a 37-meter Spanish-owned trawler flagged to Senegal, was boarded near the border with Côte d'Ivoire. Upon investigation, the vessel was found to be in violation of 26 laws and regulations, including an admission of transshipment of 20 ton of shrimp in the waters of Côte d'Ivoire. Transshipment is strictly prohibited under the Côte d'Ivoire Fishing Code. 3 of the crew were undocumented and without passports. On February 7th, the fishing vessel Shanghai, a 40-meter Chinese trawler, was boarded off the port of Monrovia, Liberia. The vessel was found to be in violation of 22 laws and regulations. The master of the Shanghai 9 was unable to produce a single vessel document, such as a certificate of registry as required by port state and flag state. It could not explain why one of the Chinese nationals for whom he had a passport was missing. Sanitation conditions on board the vessel were appalling, and Chinese nationals housed in air-conditioned cabins and the African crew, mostly Sierra Leone nationals, housed in a cockroach-infested tent on top of exposed to the elements. Investigations by the Ministry of National Defense have further uncovered systematic efforts by the owner of the fishing vessel Shanghai 9 to under-declare their landings with the criminal intent to avoid tax and customs in Liberia. As a result, the Ministry of National Defense has instructed the Liberian Coast Guard to stop and inspect every vessel owned by the fishing company. On February 18th, fishing vessel Lu Rong Yuan Yu 988, a 40-meter trawler flagged to Ghana, was boarded near the border with Côte d'Ivoire. The vessel was apprehended while actively fishing without a license, as well as fishing within the 6 nautical mile inshore exclusion zone reserved for Liberian subsistence fishing, artisanal and semi-artisanal fishing sector, and off-limits to trawlers. The Liberian Coast Guard supervised the release of the vessel's catch. The master offered the Liberian Coast Guard boarding officer an $8,000 bribe to release the vessel, a criminal act that was refused and subsequently reported. We wanted to keep the operation a secret for the first few weeks, operating under the cover of darkness so we could catch as many ships as possible by surprise, said campaign leader Peter Hammerstedt. We commend the Honorable Minister of National Defense for his steadfast resolve in prioritizing fisheries crime and bringing fishing pirates to justice. They're not going to get away with this anymore, promised Tsuma Kai. I will personally make sure that they will be punished to the full extent of the law. I will make it very, very clear that the time for illegal fishing in Liberia is over. Developing countries are particularly vulnerable to IUU fishing, which accounts for up to 40% of the fish caught in West African waters. This campaign will help Liberia crack down on unlicensed foreign industrial vessels operating in its waters and protect the 6 nautical miles closest to shore reserved for subsistence, artisanal, and semi-artisanal fishing, which employs 33,000 Liberians. In 2016, Sea Shepherd Conservation Society partnered with the government of Gabon for Operation Albacore, resulting in over 40 fishing vessel inspections at sea and subsequent arrest of 3 IUU Congolese fishing trawlers and 1 Spanish longliner. Operation Stola Stella is a continuation of Sea Shepherd Global's commitment to work with national governments to help end illegal, unregulated, and unlimited fishing. And you can find more information at www.seashepherd.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Yellowstone National Park has been filling up livestock trailers nearly every weekday for the past 2 weeks, cramming them full of wild buffalo and turning them over to tribal entities for shipment to slaughter. Approximately 600 buffalo from our own counts taken through spotting scopes set up miles away. Due to Yellowstone's enormous trap closure, we have been captured inside Yellowstone's Stevens Creek buffalo trap. Many of these buffalo were left for weeks to wallow in mud and muck, standing around in their own excrement as they wait on death row. Yellowstone has recently announced that they will provide media tours of the trap on March 1st and 8th. But since the announcement, shipments to slaughter have increased rapidly and the trap is quickly emptying. Yellowstone continues to fail to be transparent, refusing to disclose how many buffalo have been captured and providing slaughter information only every other week. Last year, we caught Yellowstone telling a blatant lie to the public about injuries suffered by buffalo inside the trap, which we are able to prove because we were there documenting. Why should we believe that what they are reporting, and why shouldn't the public demand accountability? The horrors that hundreds of wild buffalo have already suffered are only known to those who are committing these crimes against them. The continued race against the trap and in competition with each other, hunters continue to gun down or maim buffalo mainly along Yellowstone's northern boundary in the Gardner Basin. Adult female buffalo are on average 7 months pregnant right now, and many of the boulder-sized gut piles that are strewn across the hunting zones harbor buffalo fetuses that will never be born. At least 12 buffalo have been wounded by hunters and later shot by park rangers as they fled one death trap to encounter another. Other buffalo have been unknowingly shot by hunters, unclaimed, and left to die alone, while still other family groups have been wiped out entirely, with yet other hunting events creating orphans who are sure to die without the aid of a family. The Montana government's lies about brucellosis threats and population management are simply a cover-up for the real intention behind these killings, to cater to the whims of Montana livestock interests who don't want to share the land with native wild buffalo. Amidst the outrage of Yellowstone and Montana's sheer wanton destruction of our national mammal, the last wild herds in and around Yellowstone, more people are coming together and pledging solidarity to help do what we must to end these atrocious acts against the sacred. Many friends, old and new, came together for our annual Week of Action, which just ended on Monday. Folks from hundreds of miles away traveled from every direction to join us in multiple rallies and protests around southwestern Montana. We garnered great media attention, and you all helped make our national call-in day another success, ringing the phones off the hook. Our march through Gardner Basin brought strong memories of Buffalo Field Campaign's co-founder Rosalie Little Thunder's 1999 walk for the buffalo from Pine Ridge, South Dakota to Yellowstone. And as we walked, joined by Rosalie's cousin Phil Little Thunder, it sparked inspiration to make this our annual Rosalie Little Thunder Memorial Walk. We held a very special event in Helena, Montana, on the steps of the Capitol building, where we were joined by indigenous friends from many different nations, who spoke strongly, eloquently, and also drummed and sang for the buffalo. We were also honored to have 3 native state legislators join us and add their voices to the growing chorus of buffalo defenders, all who pledged to protect the sacred. After the rally, many of us took a little detour and, much to the chagrin of security, marched through the Capitol and to the governor's office, chanting, "Let the buffalo roam." Many agonizing things transpired this week. Our buffalo family is growing and getting stronger, and our resolve is strengthening. Many more than we realize are paying attention and taking actions. Though Buffalo Field Campaign's week of action has come and gone for this year, our commitment to defending the buffalo and their ability to reclaim the lands that are their birthright is a devotion we live every day. Walk with us for the wild buffalo. And you can get more information at their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's buffalofieldcampaign.org. And please remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And turning to biological diversity news, a suit has been launched to save wolves and lynx from a coppermut. The Center for Biological Diversity and Earthworks have filed a notice of intent to sue the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service for their approval of the Polymet open pit copper mine on Minnesota's Superior National Forest in violation of the Endangered Species Act. The mine would destroy nearly 4,000 acres of habitat for federally protected gray wolves and Canada lynx, as well as hundreds of acres of high-quality wetlands, and risk long-term toxic water pollution in the Lake Superior watershed. A century of iron ore mining has already fragmented habitat for wolves and lynx in this region, so they can't tolerate a new wave of open-pit copper mining, said Center Attorney Mark Fink. The impacts are just too severe to let this proceed. And you can find out more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And now I present an anarchist look at the forest fires in south central Chile in this paper from Insurrection News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. For a couple of weeks, the expansion of various firefighting areas in the forest industry business in south-central part of the country has been reported in Chile. These fires are spread over various territories and have resulted in irreparable damage to various natural ecosystems and native forests, reaching homes and causing the deaths of people and a large number of animals in what is already a true ecocide that is still continuing. These forest fires and their consequences have become the subject of a news agenda in recent weeks, with the political business and media class disinforming and imposing a version of the origin of the fires that omits or leaves last any responsibility on the part of forestry companies. In turn, given the magnitude of the catastrophe, several groups and organizations seek to support the devastated territories and criticize from various positions the way the government has tackled the problem. As anarchists, enemies of this and any society, but part of a context which we cannot elude with our silence, we want to propagate a few ideas to sharpen the practical criticism against the domination towards the earth and those who inhabit it. Despite the media campaign deployed by the power, it is a fact that the responsibility for the eco-catastrophe produced by the fires lies mainly and without any doubt in the forest and its monoculture pine and eucalyptus protected and promoted by the state of Chile for the business enrichment that it devastates ecosystems and communities. Some environmental organizations, with whom we agree only on some analysis and data, such as the Network for the Defense of Territories, rightly maintain that the main causes of the catastrophe facing the Chilean region are related to the neoliberal forest model that underpins the Chilean state in favor of the multi-million dollar oligopoly, which has been maintained for more than 40 years. This is because the fires, for the most part, have their origin in monoculture plantations. In an article, these organizations point out that, quote, "the effects of eucalyptus plantations on soil moisture reserves begin to appear at the age of 4 to 6 years, after which the water deficit during the year is similar to that observed in a mature forest. Transpiration rates differ between species of eucalyptus, fluctuating between 20 and 40 liters per tree per day. Forest plantations require a large amount of water for their development, so their impact on the availability of water resources is especially important in the less rainy areas of Chile." The same network points out that, quote, "in Chile there are an estimated 3 million hectares of forest plantations in the southern center, of which some 750,000 hectares belonging to the holding CMPC, whose main company is Forestal Mininco, controlled by the Mate Group. The remainder concentrates more than 1,200,000 hectares that corresponds to the holding Copec Antarchil, whose main forestry business is Selco Arauco de Angelini. From the military dictatorship to the civil governments, all have defended this business, calling the development to the opening of new outbreaks of extraction and services for the forest industry, forest plantations as forest, and calling the rule of law the imposition of business through repression and state terrorism. For its part, the summary information portal notes that, quote, pine and eucalyptus plantation, cellulose plants, and all the road and port infrastructure at its service are elements that, at the same time, constitute the co-generation of a substantial and exclusive business that represents the exploitation of the territories they occupy and the impoverishment of their communities, unquote. Despite all this, despite their efforts to divert attention, it is clear who is truly and mainly responsible, but there is still more. In the midst of this context, along with the traditional calls for national unity and the social alignment of people in the state under one and the same interest, sectors linked to political and economic power have tried to propagate the thesis that the forest fires and their consequences have been caused by Mapuche groups, those are the natives, or terrorist anarchists, directing the focus away from forestry companies and targeting the not-so-new internal enemies of the Chilean state. The mass media, faithful to their roles as accomplices of power, amplify such theses. The government has publicly discounted the participation of such groups after investigating, but nevertheless reinforces the idea of the ghost of terrorism as a way of explaining social problems and as a way of justifying repression against Mapuche and anarchist subversion. An example of this has been the recent arrest of a Mapuche comunero and a person from Santiago accused of being part of a guerrilla school. Press reports have also surfaced about links between Mapuche anarchists and former members of leftist military political organizations in connection with investigations into explosive incendiary attacks and assaults on money-carrying trucks in southern Chile. Recently, in the Chilean parliament, proposals are being discussed for the modification of the anti-terrorist law, seeking to expand its faculties to add amendments and incorporate the figure of the individual terrorist, thus avoiding the accusers having to discuss whether the accused person belongs to an organization classified as terrorist. In this way, power seeks to take advantage of the situation while the eyes of the alienated masses are focused on the fires and applauding the action of private firefighters and the bourgeoisie, who make their hypocritical donations in the midst of socio-environmental ecocide. For our part, as anarchists and anti-authoritarians, we are not interested in naively demanding the state to break with the business interests of groups such as Mate and Angelini, or to oversee, regulate, or end the forestry business. What we are interested in is propagating radical criticism that explains how the problem has roots that are deeper than neoliberalism, that are a consequence of the relation of power over nature and the land being understood as a commodity in the services of anthropocentric, civilized, and capitalist human interests. A vision that over centuries and millennia has intervened, modified, and destroyed native ecosystems and communities that are wild and alien to the commodification of nature under the name of development or progress. We are not interested in demanding change from an economic model to a less invasive, low-impact, or sustainable model as proposed by citizenship and legal reformation. We are interested in destroying the state and all relationships of power, replanting native forests, and at the same time fostering independent practices of living that do not depend on markets or the state of anyone trying to profit from our lives. This is always in the hands of the practice of direct action in all its forms, including the direct attack against the structures of domination, exploitation, and devastation, and their leaders and accomplices in society. No platform or legalism or petitionism to delegitimize the speeches of power, responding to the call for war against the Orisa Project, to strengthen the networks of autonomy and direct action, against civilization and all forms of authority and domination, signed, some anarchists of the Chilean region. And we found this on the Earth First Newswire. And back to biological diversity news. Tell Congress don't mess with wolf recovery. U.S. Senators Tammy Baldwin and Amy Klobuchar have introduced a new bill to strip federal protection from wolves in Wyoming and the Great Lakes region, and we need your help to stop it. The bill is an ugly political ploy that will end thousands of dead wolves and do serious damage to one of America's most important endangered species success stories. After the center and allies sued, federal judges overturned a series of bad decisions to prematurely remove Endangered Species Act protection from wolves. But with language explicitly preventing further judicial review, the new bill would reverse these court orders, end federal wolf protections, and undermine the basic rule of law and rights of citizens to challenge illegal government actions. Act now to demand that Congress let science and law govern wolf recovery, not politics. And two pesticides threaten 97% of endangered species. A new report from the EPA says 97% of the 1,800 species that are protected under the Endangered Species Act, from bears to birds to frogs, are likely to be harmed by two of the most common pesticides, malathion and chlorpyrifos. The pesticide diazinon is likely to hurt another 78%. We're now getting a far better picture of the risks pesticides pose to endangered wildlife, said center scientist Nathan Donnelly. The next step should be protecting them and public health. And you can find out more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. And you can listen in tomorrow afternoon, that's Friday at 3 p.m., for another edition, for a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update. You can also tune in to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. Or KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Also, WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, broadcasts the Earth First Update Sundays at noon. And you can listen to the Grateful Dread Public Radio online at gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. And you can also find them at TuneIn and Spotify. You can listen to Berkeley Liberation Radio in Berkeley, California, 104.1 FM, where they sometimes broadcast the Earth First Update. Or you can listen to radioforall.net anytime. That's radio, the number, forall.net. And you can also download this or previous Earth First Updates. Please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio News and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Uncle Dennis. Please tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.